Welcome back to the Dungeon Master's Block, the place where we come to talk about the Dungeon Master, the most important person in the game. With every conversation, we hope to inspire as many as possible to keep on Dungeon Mastering.
I'm one of your hosts, DM Neil, aka Jote Maniac, and today we're going to be talking about a monk subclass entitled Way of the Waking Dream. Basically, this is a great breakdown of how to make a subclass, because inevitably we as DMs are going to want to tackle this or have players that want us to better incorporate pieces of our worlds or their stories to make a subclass rather than an entirely new class. So this is a great conversation about how at a higher scale it's being approached, but all of these things are things to think about and use at our own tables. Also, dear patrons, if you keep your eyes out, we have another monster dropping on the Patreon very soon. And I guess it's one monster in two stages or two monsters, depending on how you look at it. But it is going to be titled The Rise and the Fall, because after the fall is defeated, rising up out of it is the Rise, which is a demon that had been possessing the fall, and inevitably the destruction of the fall is exactly what the Rise had always wanted. And I think it's a really fun monster that you can add into your game wherever you need to. But with that out of the way, there is only one thing left to do. Let's head to the meat.
I'm starving. We ain't had nothing but maggoty bread for 3 stinking days.
Why can't we have some meat?
The plate meat back on the menu, boys!
So today for the meat, we have a full house. I am very excited for the conversation, marginally less excited for when I have to edit all of this, but we have the minds behind Surviving Strange Hollow, and I'm just going to let you all start introducing yourselves, and then we'll start jumping into the topic at hand.
Jason, you always talk first. I'm just expecting.
I do always talk first. You're right. I tried really hard to not talk right there. I'm Jason. I am one half of the publishing company Accidental Cyclops, and my partner is down on that corner from me.
Well, I'm up here in mine, but I don't know. I don't know where we are on each other's screens. But I'm Mikey. I'm also with Accidental Cyclops, and we have with us our lead designer, Surviving Strange Hollow, Sean Merwin. Sean.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. I was on the show once. I don't even want to say how long ago it was, because it was that long ago. But I was brought on to this project, Surviving Strange Hollow, when I met with Jason and Mikey at Gen Con. And they pitched me the idea behind this book. And I was honestly looking at 2 or 3 different things I could have been doing at the time. And this is the one that I chose, because I think it has so much potential, so much cool stuff for 5e or even just any fantasy gamers out there to sink their teeth into.
Perfect. You know exactly what you're doing, which is a perfect segue into question number 2, which is there anything that you all are currently working on? And my favorite is that you can talk about. All those fun NDAs, we can't talk about those things, but I have a sneaking suspicion of what you might discuss right now.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, so Surviving Strange Hollow is based off the work of an artist, Emily Hare. She's a watercolorist out of the UK. She's just very, very talented. And we sort of looked at that art and said, there's a game here. We know there's something here that's art's just so cool. It's very different than anything we've really ever seen. Certainly in the D&D space, this is like this is begging to have a game made after it. And we reached out to her, a year and a half, 2 years ago. She said yes, which is like, oh, okay, cool. And then we kind of took it off from there. And, like Sean talked about, we got him on board at Gen Con and really, really helped us bring in just an amazing team to help bring Emily's art to a lot more people.
I don't have much more to add to that. I know Sean has a really good way of describing it, that when you see Emily's art, it feels like you've seen it before. And that's probably because you have. You just didn't know who it was. And so my daughter and I have been fans of Emily's for about 3 years now. We've bought all of her art books related to Strange Hollow or Strange Hollow adjacent stuff. And I just on a lark decided to reach out and say, hey, we're going to be looking for our next project. Let's see if Emily's willing to be on it. And the fact that she said yes was amazing. even better, she has done art for other fantasy projects in the past, including Hit Point Press and some others. Humblewood is the one that people have are probably most familiar with. It would have seen her art on.
Which recently hit D&D Beyond, so even more eyes are going to be on that, which is no doubt a boon to all of you immediately. but yeah, the idea that the old adage that a picture is worth 1,000 words, and I'm sure that you are the ones writing those 1,000 words and hearkening back to that art. Yeah. What's your pitch kind of on the Surviving Strange Hollow?
Yeah, my pitch was exactly what Jason said. When they showed me Emily's art, it was that instant recognition. I couldn't tell where I'd seen it, but I knew I had seen it before because it has such a unique ethereal quality that it's so fantasy. You look at that and you're like, okay, yes, that is fantasy. But it's so different than anything that you or most things that you get from typical 5e D&D settings. And so the instant I'm always thinking in terms of challenges, right? What's the challenge? What's the thing that hasn't been done or hasn't been done really well yet? That's what I want to work on next. So I saw that art and I said, yes, we need a setting and a game and rules and mechanics and stories that are going to back this art up, that are going to bring the art into the forefront of players and game masters, the stories they're telling, the challenges they're facing, and we need to bring this as quickly as possible to the 5e world. So that's what we're in the process of doing right now.
That is awesome. And like you said, having that evocative art that really sells. Because when you said it, I also think of the idea of being able to see a piece of art and think to myself, oh, that's 5e art. In the same way that I almost feel like I can see a piece of art, probably the one that is my background, and be like, oh, that's magic. That's on a magic card. Though they have this certain aesthetic, and rightfully so, because they want to fit the mold of what they've produced so far. But yeah, to find that evocative art to then really draw people in and then back it up with, you know, story and mechanics and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's sort of the approach we've taken with this book is I'm calling it like a top down approach where it's like, we have the art. The art existed before any of the stories or any of the game rules existed. And, you know, so we start with the art and it's like, okay, now let's have our, you know, our team of writers who, I mean, let me just say, like, not worthy to be working with this amazing team. Like, you know, when you're in a Zoom call with Ed Greenwood, like, it's weird. It's not amazing. He's just the nicest guy. You know, then we have these stories. You have these authors just writing, you know, just pure, you know, this fiction based on the art and the stories that they want to tell. And, you know, one person might be doing a fairy tale. One person might be doing, like, a captain's log type thing. And they're all telling these stories for characters that they're making in Strange Hollow. And then beyond that, it's like, okay, what rules and mechanics and things we need to put in place now based upon the themes and the stories that they're telling in this art is kind of telling us what to make.
So I have a surprise question, and I will give multiple shout outs on my surprise question. One, this surprise question was asked of me in a bar when I was at a catacon and I was sharing a meal with John Arcadian. So the question that I'll pose to the three of you, if you could, in the real world, like your own life now, have one spell that you could cast, what would it be?
We talk about this all the time.
Yes.
What a difference mending would make in my life. That is the spell that I want. Mending. Just, I could cure all of the ills of my personal life. But my actual honest answer is probably create food and water. I think that is the spell that changes the world.
Yeah, I know John. I've worked with John on quite a few projects. I could see that question coming from John. See, I'm going to be less benevolent than Jason. I'm not going to like try to fix the world. I'm going to cast teleport because there are so many people I want to talk to. There are so many things I want to see. We can get there, right? Time travel is real. Sadly, it's just in one direction at the same pace, and we're all going through it. So I need to be able to break that. I need to be able to get to where I need to be, to see the people I need to talk to have those experiences I need to have. And teleport takes care of that for me.
I mean, teleportation is the best power. Like, if a superhero power, teleportation is at the top of my list of powers. But I can't pick teleportation because you did. I'm going to go less benevolent to the world, more personal satisfaction, which is unseen servant. Just something that's going to fold my laundry, do my dishes, and just not have to worry about that stuff. That's kind of nice.
Also, Sean, as soon as you started saying it, I really thought it was going the opposite direction of there are people that I don't want to hear from and don't want to see, and you were teleporting them away. So, I mean, both sides of that coin seem to work out.
Yep.
That's true. Teleport self and teleport other, you know.
Yep.
I guess
yep.
that works.
Yeah, and during our discussion, I am kind of afraid of having any high-level spell just because I don't want to be what people seek out in the world. So I do lean certainly towards the other side. And so, and I'll take this from my own father, one of the things, not that he was certainly like the most nerdy or fantasy oriented guy, but if you ever asked him about a superpower or anything that he wanted, he would always say to speak every language. Mm. He said that it would open countless doors for you. So I think for me, going that direction of having comprehend languages, because I think there's so many things you could do, so many people that you can talk to, and like things that you can figure out from ancient history, brand new things. So yeah, I think I will go with comprehend languages and hope that I do not become a person that is sought after for this skill too much.
Man, I'm on the phone call with the wrong people. I picked the thing that makes me a slave to the world to make the world a better place, and you all are like, yeah. Man, I just want the power. Just give me the power.
I'm midway. I'll use it for good, but I'm going to hide.
I mean, I like that. That's fun.
Well, so with that out of the way, and a huge thanks to John for that question, always kind of sitting in my mind. One of the things we're here to talk about, the way of the waking dream, a monk subclass that's going to show up. But one of the reasons that I wanted to bring you all on to talk about it is because I feel like it is and a true inevitability of anyone that is running a game for any amount of time that you are probably going to decide to homebrew a subclass. I just think that, like, because it's not a whole class, I think that feels very daunting for someone to tackle, but you're going to think about the concept of why are monks different in my world? Why are this set of fighters different in my world? Why are these barbarians from this specific tribe? What are they doing? And you're going to most likely create something with your players. So the idea of having that discussion about kind of how you all came to the decisions you did, I think is a really good one. And also, I really like this class. So again, if nothing else, the podcast is just a win for me and no doubt everyone that listens. So I guess based on that sentence there, what was kind of the reasoning behind coming up with this subclass?
So I initiated the creation of this subclass in part because I have a fascination with dreams as a game mechanism. I think they are great for a game mechanism, not like a rule mechanism, but as a story mechanism, I guess, more than anything else. You know, we've created a feat that is dream based, tinkering with this subclass that's dream based. And for me, making this a monk subclass that accesses their own dreams to empower themselves makes a lot of sense. And it also fills a gap that monks have in my mind, which is D&D focuses on the martial capabilities, but not the cerebral or emotional or esoteric capabilities that are non-combat based. And I think monks are so much more broad than that. I think that was particularly the Eastern monk that it's patterned after. If you want to throw in more Western monks, it gets even more, you know, sort of academic in that way as well. So there's a breadth of monks in the world that we could be accessing. And D&D has chosen to pick Jet Li. That's their monk, right? And that's fine. They are fun to play. They're fun for combat. But for me, there needs to be another layer there. And I wanted to jump into the idea of meditation and accessing your subconscious and being able to use that for things inside and outside of combat to just really just create some more breadth there.
What Jason's talking about is one of the three pillars for me of creating D&D rules. And I call it the three Fs. The first is flavorful. The second is fun. And the third is freaking balanced. You know, flavorful being tied to the setting in a way that illuminates the setting using the rules. Fun is just, this is super fun for me to play as a player at the table. And freaking balanced is bridging that gap to make it something that is good to play. It makes the players feel like they're contributing, but not overpowering the entire game because of it. And so often we see rules design just be about the power, and that's fine. And it has to be a part of the game. But I want these rules that we're making, whether it's subclasses or feats or new abilities, new classes, whatever, to really hit the other two Fs, to be flavorful. So when I see Jason's idea of dreams being important. Dreams now have to be important to our setting. Otherwise, this subclass will still be great, but it's not going to have the same resonance when a player picks it than it would just because if they're picking it because the powers are cool.
Yeah, and I think it does. It's important for us to say all of this is still in draft status. There's a lot of playtesting that needs to happen, and we've got some people that are more talented than any of the three of us that still need to look at this stuff and dev edit it to make it really, really good. But Sean is right. It needs to connect to the world at large, the world that Emily has imagined, but that we're trying to augment for D&D. And there are so many non-combat things that are dangerous that we are bringing into Strange Hollow. And the idea that we are trying to elevate the game, the play, to something more than hit points and armor class, I think this subclass plays into that at a spiritual level and at a level of that makes you want to understand what's happening below the surface of Strange Hollow.
Yeah, and I love the idea of layering in the... It also made me think of the pillars, but layering in the idea of dreams during combat. Because one of the things about combat is I'm prone to it just as much as I'm sure everyone else is. We start to just get into number, and that's kind of combat. But the idea that as that character, once or more per round, we're going to start talking about dreams. We're going to start having albeit small, but still important narrative discussion about those dreams and what they're meaning and then their direct mechanical effect while you're in combat and being able to layer those things in and have those touch points to then have subsequent conversations after the battle, I think is... I just want to figure out how to do that all the time because I mean, I've certainly had it where a PC and an NPC have a conflict and then two of us are yelling at each other about that, you know, in the combat, but that I find that rare. So figuring out ways, like you said, to have it be balanced, but also have flavorful combat, I think this is a really, really interesting way to go ahead and do that.
I mean, and I'm envisioning a monster that steals your dreams. All right. You get bit by this monster, you fail your save. It's taking your dreams. What does that mean to you? How do you get your dreams back? You could have a short role-playing session, or you could turn it into an entire story arc for multiple characters. And that's, you know, one of the things that we are looking at as we build this world for Strange Hollow.
Yeah, and when that creature steals your dreams, maybe you're having to make some sort of wisdom or constitution check to actually engage in long rest because you are not getting a rest because you're not getting your dreams. And what are the ramifications for your entire party because you can't get that complete rest? And how do you deal with that?
Yep.
And my immediate thought of that second layer is something akin to lycanthropy where they've bit you, they've passed away, but you don't get to dream because they are there. Mm-hmm. So now they're inside of you and then figuring out long term how you're trying to get rid of that. Oh, and then, you know, that player that's like, well, then I'm just going to bite somebody else and not have this problem anymore. we certainly all have that player. I know things are in a draft form. So then, like, I think we'll be kind of touch and go on some of the specific mechanics. But if anyone wants to either bring forth basic ideas of some of the abilities of the subclass, and then we can kind of talk around some of those. But like I said, whatever level to which you're comfortable with sharing, and then we can talk about it because I like everything that I'm seeing.
I think probably avoiding a bunch of the specifics is a good idea. I think we can talk about the mechanisms we want to toy with the subclass because this is going to go through editing. I'm going to name drop real quick. This is going to get massaged a lot by Dan Dillon, I'm sure, who's on our team. He's gonna look at this and say, it's a fine concept. Here's some things that are going to make it 17 times better. And, you know, Sean has already looked at the text that we've written and said, look, yeah, you're there's a mark and you aimed at it and you're kind of near it, but we got to make it hit it. Right. And so we're going through that process with a lot of these rules still. So that said, I think diving into the basic things that we're tinkering with is a good idea and will be fun, but probably not promise what anything's going to do.
No, and honestly, I feel like that makes even for a more valuable conversation for anyone listening, thinking about what they'd like to do at their own table. Because, you know, as we're discussing, Sean Merwin and Dan Dillon are looking at it. That's probably not what's going to happen at your home table. Also, the idea that even in spite of that, until it starts hitting play and you see that synergy with some other things that maybe you hadn't even thought about, there are some things, scenarios that aren't going to come up. So always my piece of advice when you're not trying to put something out for the mass market and it's for your home table, be okay to change it. Be okay to change it after the fact to say, hey, you know what? Or even have that open conversation right out front to say, hey, I do not know how this will interact with some of the other choices that the party will make. And there is a chance that either direction, we may need to bring this back or we may need to boost this up as long as you're willing to go on this journey with me. And then again, that's going directly back to the three pillars that you were talking about. I can come up with two out of three probably out the gate, but the third one's going to need to be at the table and a lot of decisions will have to be made there. So
that's true.
I think it's also important to note that we've seen a lot of Unearthed Arcana come out, and there's a lot of focus on what the monk is going to be in D&D 5.5 or D&D 1. And we have intentionally set our publish date to be after most of the D&D 1 stuff comes out so that we can fully flesh these out to be compatible with that version as well as the current version of D&D. So it's kind of hard to talk knowing what we know about what the monk is going to be in 6 months. You know, we've got to start factoring that in to what this subclass is going to do as well.
And one of the challenges in doing what we're doing is we're making a setting. It's not necessarily a world. It's a setting that you can treat as its own world, and you can run a particular Strange Hollow campaign, or you can put it into your own world. And then we need to be cognizant of the fact that maybe game masters will be mixing this with some other aspects. So we always have to be aware of that. If we build a completely new system for curses, how will that interact with what classes can do right now? If we add ways that characters in Strange Hollow can use subclasses to deal with curses, how does that work if a DM doesn't have any characters that can deal with them? So all of that is going to be on the top of our minds or near the top of our minds as we go forward with these different rules.
Yeah, I guess I'll jump in and kind of just talk about the core conceit of this class, which is using snippets of your own dreams from your most recent rest, either your long rest or meditating during a short rest, and being able to use those in a similar way to luck dice. So you can essentially have foresight. I saw this combat or this event happening in my dream an hour ago. Now it's happening, and I know what the result is going to be, granting me probably something akin to advantage or a reroll, kind of like a luck dice, because of that.
Which has a lot of narrative, because dreams can, you know, they're open to interpretation. So like the idea that like this is, I saw a version of it, I think of, you know, thinking back to all the other versions of dreams that we're starting to see in media where, you know, Marvel is alluding to the idea that every time you dream, you're just watching another version of yourself in another world. So then even alluding to some of that to say, you know, there is interpretations and I was a little bit wrong or I zigged what I should have zagged. And, you know, is it a mirror of what is happening? So I think even in, I guess I'm saying that to say that even in failure of that reroll, I think there's still a lot of narrative ability to have discussion.
Absolutely. Even if you remembered perfectly what your dream was, it doesn't mean that that dream was accurate in the way that the real world, we think of the real world as being real or accurate, right? It was my subconscious interpreting a thing, a stimulus that may or may not come to pass, and me making a choice based on a stimulus that may or may not come to pass. There's a lot of gray area there.
Like you said, the luck dice component, but then it's also potentially tying back into the mechanics directly of the monk. I guess, do you think the feel is on table? Like, what do you want the monk class, this specific subclass, to kind of feel like in play? Because like you alluded to originally, and I've done this, is it's really not hard to scrub most of the things off of the monk class and me just say I'm a brawler. Like, it's the current version is relatively close in that is very attainable to kind of just say no and I just punch things. Mm-hmm. So what is kind of the at table feel of this subclass you were going for?
I think it's a reflective character. This is the sort of when you adopt the subclass, I think it's what, level three, when monks get their first, when they dive into their tradition, right? And for me, it is a character that is focused on being reflective. It's probably like that high wisdom character. You know, you're going to build a monk with a high wisdom anyway, but really focusing on that as your core identifiable attribute. And you're someone who is analyzing situations quietly and trying to suss out what are the motives of the people around you? What are the most likely circumstances? Maybe you're looking at the world sort of geometrically in a way too. It's like, I'm standing here. If I need to, I can throw this apple and bounce it off that tree and hit that guy in the back of the head, right? You're looking at all the situations from every angle that you possibly can. And to me, that's the sort of insightful, reflective character that I think this subclass lends itself to.
The other thing is having the person that's playing this class is also has the opportunity to decide how they dream. Mm-hmm. Because while we have kind of pointed to the idea of, oh, I saw something, I saw this happen before, there's nothing to say they couldn't have thought, or every time they dream, everyone is an animal. Or every time that they dream, it is fractal. You said geometrics, and it made me think of kind of like, what if it's a trippier version for them? And it's fractals and geometrics and things like that. So then they have those angles in that, you know, in their head, the math of it. But then again, it's really, sometimes it's very difficult to interpret those things. So the narrative options continue to grow as our discussion moves forward, clearly.
And the thing that I didn't mention earlier is we're tying it to key as well. So to be able to do that ability to access those dream, I don't know what to call them right now, dream dice of some sort, luck dice, you're spending key to do that too. So you are tapping into that core mechanism of monks too. It's not disjointed. I think you brought that up and saying, what are the core mechanisms of monks? And that's how this ties to that.
This is the perfect example of moving between these three pillars, right? You think of the flavor that you want. All right, we want dreams. What about nightmares? Are dreams different than nightmares? Do we need to put in a nightmare mechanic along with the dream mechanic? So you start thinking in terms of flavor. Then you're like, okay, how do we do this? Is it rolling extra dice? How complicated do we want to make it? Do we want, when you wake up after a long rest, to flip a coin or roll a D6 and see whether you had a dream or a nightmare? And does that change how you can change things? The Circle of Stars Druid has a wheel and a woe omen, which is exactly that. If you, for wheel, then it's, you can, you know, help people. If it's woe, you can detract from people. Does that come into play? And then it comes back around to the fun. Oh, is that fun? Yeah. Okay. I think that's fun for a lot of people. It gives a little randomness to it. All right, now let's take that to the flavor side of things. What does that mean about dreams and nightmares in Strange Hollow? And you just keep going around in circles with your design as you touch on all of these different points, and it builds up and builds up and builds up until you have like the perfect rule set for the thing that you're trying to employ in the game.
Well, I mean, especially when you're introducing something new, one of the big things is certainly whatever player has made this choice, have all of the discussions we're having right now, you need to have with that player. That way it's, oh man, because I don't know that I want to be overly surprised by but you know, from like sitting on the other side of the screen, mm-hmm. I don't know how shocked I want to be when a new class is introduced, and the way that the person wants to introduce dreams for two reasons. It's like, one, I don't want to feel like I'm caught unawares. And more specifically for me, I don't want to feel like I can't help them because of that. Like I can't help them do those pillars that fun and flavorful because I was so unaware of how they felt this class should operate. And while this one, I feel like it leans a little bit more that direction because of how varied it can be. That's true of everything. It's true of every fighter. That's true of every class that shows up. If you're not having those discussions with your players, there's things you'll be surprised by, and maybe you get lucky and you're able to move that forward. But if you're more aware, you can start to just layer things in that'll already play into exactly what they want.
Yeah, what I see happening at the table is if I'm playing this monk and I want to use this ability, you know, the DM says, okay, well, the orc caught you in the shoulder with its axe. And I'm like, no, that's what happened in my dream last night. What's actually happening is, and then I roll again, right? I spend my key and I roll again. And I'm like, I learned from my dream. I knew what was going to happen. And now I'm altering my play. And I get to introduce, you know, a little bit of the fun mechanic in that, you know, that's a cool story and all, Mr. DM, but here's what's actually going to happen. And then, you know, calling out and making that fun and saying that orc takes that swing, but I deflect the blow, which the new monk coming out apparently can maybe deflect melee attacks, which is fun. And this time I'm successful. And that's what this looks like.
Yeah. Or even having, you know, just some level of damage mitigation, like in the idea of that you can deflect the blow, but it's not so much. So, you know, the orc hits you square into the neck and you said, no, it, you know, a scratch on my shoulder, something to that effect. And yeah, the idea of I love turning it back. I'd love to have it turned back on me because that's fine. As many things as I throw at my players, I need something for them to verbally throw at me, not physically throw at me. So the idea that they could then have that back and forth, and I think that's I know for me that's an important piece, because if it really just is me saying things, I don't know, I have the podcast for that. The whole thing is I want the back and forth, or else I would just be a player. I don't know, you guys get what I'm saying. If there's not a back and forth, it's not fun. The pillar's gone.
Yeah, I think it's more about like when we're kind of thinking, reframing how when we play games and someone is dungeon master. It's not the dungeon master versus the player. It's the dungeon master is, you know, kind of in service to the players, like, but we're all trying to tell a story. The game master, dungeon master, is coming up with the story beats because somebody has to know where the train is going. But, you know, the players and the dungeon master are all interacting about how does this work? Well, this thing happens, and like, okay, that's interesting. Well, what about this? And it's a conversation, kind of leading back to, you know, your earlier thing about like, well, I'm going to make up the subclass and it might not work. And just being open to that conversation about how to move the game forward and move the character forward, and being, you know, oh, well, what if we do this or this? Like, oh, that sounds interesting. Let's do that. Okay, cool. Let me go in that direction.
And I think it's the larger trend of, and D&D is doing this now too, giving opportunities for player agency in that story creation process. And little things like this can do that to some extent. The system needs to support it, obviously, but there are little things you can do with the monk class in this regard, with this power, or with the luck mechanism, or whatever else you're talking about with D&D inspiration, where you are saying, I want to take a little bit of narrative control. I'm going to use my inspiration die or my luck die to change the course of the story in a way that's more fun for me and hopefully everyone else.
And so to, I guess, a little bit of how the sausage is made on this particular podcast is, you know, I've seen the basic mechanics of the current draft of this subclass. And what's interesting to me is that I can already see the narrative development behind leveling up in the subclass, if that makes sense. So much to say that starting out in this class, what you're capable of doing is looking at your own dreams, which makes perfect sense. That's how I can do it. Okay, I'm terrible at it. I don't like really lucid dream at all. But in theory, a person in our real world can really focus on their own dreams and seek to gain knowledge from that. But as you develop in this class, surprise, I can start to manipulate or see into or work with the dreams of others. And like even that idea that I can just read what is essentially just mechanics and also pull out the narrative of as I get stronger, I can start doing this to not only other people, but other things as I get towards being able to not necessarily manipulate, but have those dreams directly impact what other people are doing.
I was thinking of it exactly that way. The concentric circles, right? There's or spheres of influence, and there's a psychological or therapeutic philosophy called spheres of influence. You know, you can control the things that are in your sphere. You can influence the things that are in the sphere outside of your sphere. And then there's a third sphere where you have no control and no influence. And you have to be okay with that to not let the world cause anxiety to you.
I call that the Comic-Con effect. When you go to San Diego Comic-Con, you're going to do the thing you're doing, and you can go with the other people that are doing the thing you're doing. And over there, there are 10,000 people and you don't know what they're doing, and you need to not know because you need to go where mm-hmm. you're supposed to go mm-hmm. or you don't get to see the thing that you want to see.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also Mikey's going to like this story or this concept. It's sort of the I'm at a Pathfinder Society table at Gen Con, and my sphere of influence is I can control my actions and my behaviors and have fun with myself. I can influence the actions and behaviors of the people at the table. That storyteller is beyond my control, and they always suck. That's That's my experience.
Only when you're at the game. When you're not at the table with me, I have good DMs and storytellers. Right? You show up at Pathfinder or D&D.
You nailed it, Neil. This is really about that concentric circle philosophy. You get to sixth level and get that next realm of power, which is accessing the dreams of those close to you, your forebears. You can access some of their skills and abilities for short periods of time by, again, spending your key and getting into their dreams and accessing those things. And then as you go farther, you get to the dreams of others, right? Those that are around you, and you can manipulate their results by manipulating their dreams.
It's really fun when mechanics like that build on each other, where it feels like it's an evolution of a power. Not just like I can do thing X and now I can do thing Y. That's totally different than thing X. It's like it feels more like an evolution and it feels more narrative in that way. It's like sometimes, you know, and I'm not saying like sometimes it's like, oh, well, I'm a level 2 wizard and I'm a bladesinger, so now I can just wear armor. It's like, how do you make sense of that at a table narratively? It's like, it just happens versus this. It feels like that natural progression that like, oh yeah, you can do this now. That makes sense, kind of a thing.
So one of the other questions I realize I have not touched on in any way, shape, or form, but I think is important of the discussion is, so how do these monks fit into the world? Because that's another important question that everyone homebrewing is going to need to homebrewing or even, you know, dropping this directly into their own game is going to need to answer. Is it super prevalent and you're going to find them in every large town? Is it on the top of this one very specific mountain, but at the same time, they're well known because they travel a lot? Or is it this is the first and only you've ever seen? Kind of those kind of things.
It's a great question there, and I can't give you a 100% answer, in part because of the nature of the Strange Hollow supplement, which is we want it to fit into anybody's world. So we've designed or are designing Strange Hollow such that it is mostly wilderness. There are a few places where inhabitants are permanently located. By and large, it is a transient population of people who are exploring and probably attempting to exploit Strange Hollow in some way. And so that makes it hard to talk about populated areas intentionally, because we want narrators, storytellers, game designers of their own to put their own homebrew, put this inside their own homebrew world with their own cities and towns. And this is a remote place near that, right? All that said, my imagination of this is that we will create some kind of temple somewhere, some kind of monastery where you go to train in understanding dreams. And it's in or near Strange Hollow because of the specific magical energies at that node of that part of Strange Hollow.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it any better, right? That's what we want to put it out there so game masters can take the idea and mine it for their own worlds. But we also want to tie it directly to Strange Hollow in a variety of ways to give a real impactful story reason for these things, maybe not being anywhere else in the world except for in the vicinity of Strange Hollow.
I like it. So we're starting to come around. So one of my favorite questions that I get to ask is there any air quote homework that we can give our listeners to kind of start to get some ideas about this? I have already come up with what is now an unreasonable list in my head. So I can certainly kick us off of things that either they could read, that they could watch, that they could just experience in general to just kind of get a better idea. The one I just thought of as we were just talking right now was the first Christopher Nolan Batman movie, when he goes and like they use the flower, like the idea that learning more, basically forcing you by some metric or mechanic into the dream state while being monitored by someone, it seems like a really interesting narrative way to like develop those skills of, hey, I'm right here and you're going to be air quote kind of dreaming because of this thing you just took, but I'll help you. Don't worry. We'll help usher you along. And then the other one I thought of that I had watched recently when you talked about the ability to think of the dreams of the forebears is Echo.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
The recent Marvel series. I think that's a really good touch point for anyone that wants to see a really well done version of how that can happen. Because she's able to kind of see backwards through many generations and be able to have touch points and find ability.
Yeah, I love both really good examples. I drafted this before I saw Echo, and I'm not familiar with the comic book. So that is purely coincidental, but I did love Echo. I've since watched it. That was really good. For me, it was the flower. I'm glad you brought up flowers, because the Black Panther, where he goes into the dream realm and taps into his ancestors. And to me, Black Panther is a monk of a character, like a monk with some pretty cool gear, mind you, but a monk, just his personality and the way he fights is very monk-like in my mind. And so I drew some inspiration from that for sure. Anybody else have one?
I don't have anything for that particular subclass, but I, you know, for Strange Hollow in general, think about the Amazon. That's one touch point we keep coming back to. Just how dangerous it was to people when they first went in, how there was no safe place there, but it was teeming with resources that people wanted to get to. So I see this as a place where everyone is going to have a reason to want to go in, whether it's mystical or in terms of just greed, in terms of finding new magic, in terms of finding new resources. But once they get in there, they learn quickly that it is not a place to be trifled with. And it's going to take a lot of thought and gameplay prowess just to be able to survive in Strange Hollow, much less to conquer it, hence the surviving Strange Hollow name.
Yeah. And what I love about you bringing that up about Strange Hollow on the whole is it brings us an opportunity to talk about one of the key factors, that there are no indigenous people here. So when the Europeans were going into the Amazon, you hear anecdotes or historical records of them getting saved by some of the indigenous people, told not to come back, but saved by the indigenous people. And you don't get that benefit in Strange Hollow because there is nobody here that empathizes with you.
That's one of the reasons why we wanted to start with stories, with fiction. And we tapped folks like Ed Greenwood and James Hake, who worked on the Critical Role books, and Elisa Teague, who has done lots of puzzles, as well as lots of other role-playing games in addition to 5e, and Dale Kingsmill, who is a great mind on mythologies and turning those into game products, and Aaron Roberts, who is a great game designer and fiction writer, and Brian Steele, who has worked on many games as well. And they're all coming at this with this idea, with this theme of survival and overcoming obstacles to get to this mysterious place. But they're all coming at it from a different direction. And it's been fun to see their outlines and see their work in progress as they tell these stories that I think players of games like D&D are really going to enjoy and want to tell stories of their own in similar veins.
They are. Yeah. And you're tapping into, I know almost everyone you're talking about either personally or just their work, and you're tapping into the things that they do best, which is certainly, I mean, why would you do it? Why would you do it any other way? Of course. The other one I thought of, and if you haven't seen it, it's an absolute must watch. It's a bit aggressive at times of a show, but if you have not watched Scavenger's Reign, it's kind of that same concept where basically a ship lands on a planet and there are basically no other, not sentient, but sapient life forms really there. And they're having to navigate what do we do to survive and how do we adapt to this world with the resources that we have basically no understanding.
I don't know if people can see that. I'm literally holding up a text chain from today where a buddy of Mikey's and mine sent us and said, "You guys got to watch Scavenger's Reign. It's really good."
Well, I agree. I don't know who that person is, but yeah, I agree with them wholeheartedly. I had to stop myself from watching it in its entirety. But yeah, I think that's another really good touch point for arriving somewhere that is. And it's an interesting concept because I feel like this will probably harken to what you're going for. It's not that it's inhospitable. It's that you're in many ways, you're a foreign object. Mm-hmm. In the same way that, if you get an eyebrow piercing, your body will eventually push it out because it's a foreign object in your body. You are arriving to a space and place that you don't understand, and you are not working with it. So it is working against you. That's how this functions.
Yep.
All right. So the final question is, where can people go either to find all of the work that you're doing, or if we want to point them specifically to Surviving Strange Hollow, just kind of hit me with the interweb links and all of those things.
Yeah. So we launched on March 5th. So we're a few days in. Things are going great. We have to assume we were just beforehand. I think 5 days into the campaign, we're doing awesome. And I'm putting that out there now. That's my projection.
That's the energy you got to put out into the universe, Jason.
It's the dream you had that you were projecting forward.
That's absolutely right. Nice. Yes.
I like it.
Live on Kickstarter. It should not be hard to find. Look up Surviving Strange Hollow. Links will be in the notes here, I'm sure. You can find out more information about the project without going to Kickstarter by going to accidentalcyclops.com. You can also find us on Facebook and X, which hurts me to say, but I did say it before saying Twitter, so I'm proud of myself. And we are at Fun with One Eye, an I spelled out as in the organ on your body.
That works. Okay, well, I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to see more of it. And of course, like you said, there will be links in the show notes. And hopefully it's not an undisclosed amount of years before we have you all back.
Sounds good.
We appreciate you having us on.
Yes, thank you so much.
We just want to thank the team from Surviving Strange Hollow for coming on, talking us through the iterative process of The Way of the Waking Dream, and especially with an opportunity to talk about it when it is in its earliest stages and those conversations are still being had about how to further develop it. And if you head over to Kickstarter, I can tell you right now, it is already funded and just going to be breaking through whatever stretch goals they set forth. But if you wanted to tell us about a subclass that you've added to your world, we would absolutely love to hear about it. And you can do that at dungeonmasterblock@gmail.com. And of course, if you head over to Apple Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice, leaving us a rating and review, we'll love it. We will absolutely love it because it helps defeat the evil algorithm. That's the next monster we need to make for the Patreon. First name Al, last name Garithm. Or would you just call it Garithm? Yeah, close enough. And of course, you can follow us on social media. Just look up Dungeon Masters Block. And of course, on Twitter, we're at @DMS_block. And we recently joined Blue Sky, Threads, kind of anything we can find. We're usually there and you should be able to find us. But of course, as always, we're a proud member of the Block Party Podcast Network, where you can check out other shows like Detentions and Dragons, Dungeons and Dragons and Daughters, and more. Dear listener, we want to thank you for listening to the Dungeon Master's Block, the place where we come to talk about the Dungeon Master, the most important person in the game, the only person capable of playing God, killing characters, and lowering the ego of everyone else at the table. I'm DM Neil. Good night, good luck, and keep on Dungeon Mastering.
It's not inspiration, it's not wisdom, and it's bad advice.
Before starting every session, you should tell your players all about the dreams that you had.
Goodbye.